For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way towards salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. Or in the words of Paul, at present we see indistinctly, as in a mirror, but then face to face. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave.
Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle, here with Timothy O'Donnell. Kent Blanford is here with us in the cave, too. And, Tim, I was reading the other day about what shall be a nameless Catholic university. We're not going to drop any names or whatever, but they have...
It's one people would recognize, I imagine.
Probably, but in their philosophy department, they have
a philosophy. That's good.
They do have a philosophy department. Good, that's good. But the bad news is they have a what they're calling a climate committee. So
gadzooks, what's that?
So this is a committee that meets. It's members of faculty, members of the administration.
Climate change?
Yeah, I don't know if there's student representation on it. Not climate change. But in this philosophy department, they want to make sure that the climate remains inclusive and open and welcoming to people who may have differing opinions and differing. So you know, the idea sounds good, right? It sounds like a good thing. But ultimately, what you've got is you've got Big Brother, to a certain extent, being introduced into a philosophy department of a major Catholic university to make sure that the...
You do not offend.
That the teaching remains politically correct. That's correct.
Yeah.
So political correctness has gone from unspoken code to
formal
code with an entire committee and apparatus.
Project.
To make sure that it is enforced.
Yeah. Well,
within a philosophy, I mean, you know, philosophy is supposed to be the most open of disciplines.
Right.
You know, it's supposed to be where the exchange of ideas, that's the whole idea, is the exchange of ideas. We don't do science. We don't do math and philosophy. We exchange ideas. That's what we do.
Well, and the fact that, first red flag for me is would be a euphemism. So when you use a euphemism like climate committee,
right.
You know, to sort of obfuscate what you're all about, right there, there's likely to be trouble behind it or problems. And so, like you said, euphemisms often take good things that are good, generally speaking, but then sort of fog it all up for us and smuggle in things that are not so palatable.
Right. Now, somewhat in defense of this climate committee, I was reading some of the minutes of their meetings. You know, they're required by their bylaws to meet, you know, at least once a year. And so I was reading some of the proceedings and they're talking about, you know, making sure that women voices and minority voices within philosophy, you know, are included, making sure that syllabuses reflect a more broader base of, you know, like I said, non-white males, basically. but that's really moving away from the idea of the pursuit of truth, right? You know, if the idea is you're supposed to be pursuing truth, it doesn't matter who it was that spoke that truth. It doesn't really matter, you know, where that truth is coming from. If the idea is to pursue truth, the idea of inclusivity would seem to kind of almost say, no, we're going to go off in a different direction rather than pursuing truth.
Yeah, that's where it could go off the rails, right? So I think all of us would say, hey, you know, a broader array of voices, generally speaking, sounds certainly worth considering. It's about, well, how do we go about that? So we have to understand that, or I think I'm of the mind that, you know, not every thinker, every philosopher is of equal value to study. And when you study in, say, an academic setting like a university, there's only so much time that you have. That there's only so much coursework you can include. And so you are always, as a professor or lecturer, what have you, you're always making trade-off decisions to include one thing but not another. And so to take, you know, just to, for the sake of, say, gender alone or race alone or something like that, to replace like an Aquinas, to me, would not be the right way to go. But is it worth looking at the curriculum to see if there aren't ways to broaden our set of understandings? I think that's great, but we're not going to be able to solve this on our own, are we?
Well, no. To continue this conversation, to kind of talk about what is the ideal of education in general, Catholic education specifically, what are we trying to do within a university setting in general, and probably even more specifically in a philosophy department. We're going to invite one of our old friends back to the show.
Yes.
Dr. Peter Redpath. So stick with us. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to have Dr. Peter Redpath with us.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor, tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
Think of all the media our young people are exposed to today. MTV, movies, what passes for entertainment on TV, song lyrics that are questionable or worse. Where do they hear the message that it's okay to be chaste and modest, or that it's not crazy to practice their faith, or to believe in a God who loves them and can forgive them no matter what they do? Catholic Radio is the answer. Be sure to tell your friends and relatives about Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Timothy O'Donnell, and still here is Mark Tuttle. But we are super excited to welcome back a frequent guest of the show, a great Catholic philosopher and educator, all-around Catholic gentleman, Dr. Peter Redpath. Welcome back to the Catholic Cave.
Thank you very much, Timothy, Mark. I'm very happy to be back with you.
Well, for some of our listeners, just a little background on Dr. Redpath. He's been on the show several times in the past. We're going to talk about some really exciting upcoming events, as well as kind of the state of Catholic education. Dr. Redpath is the author of well over 10 books, numerous articles. You're involved in leading and the founder of many, many different intellectual Catholic societies. I know Etienne Gilson. I know you also are the rector of the Adler Aquinas Institute. You also teach at Holy Apostles and on and on and on. That's why we're so grateful to have you back here once again to get us kind of up to speed on it. Love for you to comment a little bit about Catholic education in general. Maybe give us, Dr. Redpath, for our listeners, as you kind of look across Catholic education, both domestically and I know you're involved internationally, kind of Give us a sense of the pulse of Catholic education.
Well, it's pretty much in the same state as Western education in general. In fact, I just submitted an opinion piece about this. I was asked to do it for a Polish Catholic newspaper about the chief cause of the increasingly poor self-understanding of Catholic colleges and universities, why so many of them are becoming Catholic in name only. My conclusion about that basically is because from its inception, Catholic education, I'm going back, to the beginnings of the time of the Church Fathers, they never, when the Church first started to develop educational institutions, it did so with an imprecise a kind of generic self-understanding about human nature and about the chief aims of education related to philosophy, especially, and how philosophy relates to theology. And it wasn't until around the 13th century that, with St. Thomas Aquinas, that some of these issues that really can solidify the principles of education has started to be established within the church. Aristotle's got this terrific passage in Book 1, Chapter 5 of On the Heavens. De Coelo, where he says that small mistakes in the beginning down the road tend to lead to major mistakes. And what he meant by that chiefly was that small mistakes about first principles.
Oh yeah.
You're wrong about your first principles. you're setting up a foundation which is poor. It's going to be weak. And so eventually you're going to have a terrific amount of problems. The problem with contemporary Catholic colleges and universities is they lack self-understanding because they're mistaken about the first principles, including their aims, their chief aims, which is one of the first principles of education, and human nature. You can't be wrong about human nature. You can't be wrong about chiefly what you're educating, and the methods that you go about educating, and possibly be right about the methods that you're going to use, the procedures that in which you're going to engage.
So, did the Catholic universities just sort of simply over time wind up adopting the first principles that have kind of governed secular education? At least, I guess, looking kind of 20th century America. Or is there sort of, I guess, a new set of first principles, or just a total lack of any type of first principles that's happened?
Yeah, they more or less have adopted the educational principles of the Enlightenment, the secular Enlightenment, and this to a large extent, this happened in the middle of the 20th century, where Catholic colleges and universities wanted to become mainstream, at least in the United States, but also in Europe, didn't want to feel ghettoized, that issue is complicated in the United States, because when Catholic colleges and universities were set up in the U.S., one of the chief reasons they were set up was to enable immigrants to become mainstreamed into the population, and so the educational institutions were pretty much vocational, with a little bit of liberal arts, the intention of the church at the time was good. It was well intentioned, the chief aim of education from the beginning, when the church fathers were working on it, was to make human beings wise.
Oh, you don't hear that too much anymore. Like, education's aiming at wisdom.
Right.
You hardly ever hear that.
And so what chiefly education aims at Catholic institutions today, is vocational training, getting people a job. Mm-hmm. So it inclines to attract people on that basis. And
it's very technocratic, right? I mean, this is something like I know Mark hates it when I drop names, but I recently picked up Technology by Neil Postman.
I don't mind you dropping that name. No,
he's spot on. I mean, he talks about how we've really reduced everything to sort of something. This is why I want to talk to you, Dr. Redpath, because I think you're like-minded. All of reality is being reduced to a mathematical concept of one kind or another. In fact, I was at this symposium a few weeks ago at Benedictine College in Atchison, Kansas, and I got to tell you, that is a very that is a reason to be hopeful. At least that's a bright spot, I think. Well,
and
one
Matt
of the
Kurowski is out there in their philosophy department.
Yes, yes, and one of the keynote speakers, who's at a very prominent Catholic college that shall remain nameless, that also just recently instituted a climate committee in their philosophy department, but had this to say. He said, you know, the students that I'm seeing, this is, you know, this is a Catholic university is not an inexpensive tuition proposition, right? So it costs some money to go. Is this, he says, the students that are showing up are, you know, they're kind-hearted, they have, they're respectful, for generally speaking, they seem to have a genuine care about others. They've had numerous high emotional spiritual experiences, and they're empty-headed. And I think that's the problem, is that a lot of the Catholic education leading up to this has been focused on, or even our youth groups, say, through high school, have been increasingly favoring sort of emotional highs that have a spiritual kind of, I would say, kind of feel to them. And what we've completely seemed to have left behind, and it's something we've talked about before, is we've left behind doctrine, right? That there's no, the doctrine just is not being taught, or if it's being taught, it's just not sticking, or it's not being taught with enough, stickiness to it.
Yeah, and there's certainly no philosophical edifice that's being instilled in these kids to build doctrine upon.
Church's chief problem here is that the overwhelming majority of the hierarchy in the church does not understand the nature of philosophy, they haven't understood the nature of philosophy since its inception. And this is not a mistake. This is not a problem chiefly on the part of the church, or it's a problem related to the transition of philosophy from the ancient Greeks into the beginning of Christian culture, where the ancient Greeks had started to lose their understanding of the nature of philosophy before it came into Christianity. Catholic colleges and universities have a chief aim the institution starting around the year 1200, coming out of the cathedral schools and the monastic schools. They aimed at producing people possessed of science. But what's happened to the understanding of science since the 17th century is that it's been reduced to mathematical physics, and the whole of truth is supposed to be contained in mathematical physics, which is supposed to be an enlightened opinion. Testing, having hypotheses that you test and you somehow verify through mathematical technologies, and that proves you have knowledge. Before you had this method, no kind of science could possibly have existed. So the church has bought in to this understanding of science. And so it in almost an apologetic fashion, because of the Galileo trouble that they had coming out of the beginnings of the development of modern contemporary mathematical physics, it's apologetic.
I'll tell you what, it's worse than Galileo, though, because they just came out with a new movie called Agora, which highlights, second only to Galileo, is the quote-unquote, Christian killing of the ancient Greek philosopher, female philosopher. What's her name? Hyapatia? She was killed supposedly by at the order of Cyril of Saint Cyril of Alexandria.
Right, along with the burning of the library there in Alexandria.
Exactly. That's all going to be revisited upon us here shortly. When that movie's released here in the United States later this summer.
Right. Now this
so it's all going to flare up again.
But now, the central problem of the church not necessarily having a solid grasp of the objects of philosophy, St. John Paul II tried to address that within the church with Fides et Ratio, and kind of a call back to trying to do authentic, true philosophy and reestablish philosophy as sort of the handmaid of theology.
Right. Well, the ancient Greeks actually conceived of philosophy as a psychology. as an act of the soul. Ancient classical philosophies that when it starts to reach its high point around the time of Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, has a faculty psychology that underlies the different disciplines that are studied, which relate to qualitatively different kinds of organizations. Philosophy for the ancient Greeks was an organizational psychology. It was a habit of the human soul that was distinguished by different, qualitatively different kinds of organizations that that interested the ancient Greeks to study. And that understanding that philosophy is chiefly an act of the human person. That's something that Pope John Paul tried to get back to. He understood this. The church has abandoned its faculty psychology. The understanding that that human education is chiefly an education of the human soul, and science is chiefly a perfection of the human soul. It's like pretty much all moderns, it's separated science from the human soul, and has identified science more or less with this technological manipulation of the physical universe, so that the universe bends to your will. This ability to apply technology, it's reduced the whole of science to productive and practical knowledge, to tool making.
Right. All kinds of wicked tools too, not just good ones.
Right, but to get back, I guess the question gets raised: do we have sort of the institutions, and to a certain extent, the places within modern contemporary society to be able to do philosophy as it was done in ancient Greece?
No, because you don't have the critical mass of people on the faculties at institutions of higher education who understand chiefly what the ancient Greeks were doing. The notion that the highest form of intellectual knowledge that we have is this kind of mathematically constrained guessing is absolutely ridiculous. In fact, to try to defend that kind of claim, it requires that you engage in the act of speech, that you talk. Scientific demonstration is chiefly an act of speaking, where you have to talk to people and you have to persuade them that something or other that you're doing in some way is good. In some way improves the human condition.
Wow.
To claim that simply you have this act of will by means of which you can dominate this or that is not an intellectual activity. It doesn't improve the intellect whatsoever. In reducing it to an act of will, where what you're doing is having mathematics constrain the will, guide it more or less, so that it acts with precision. You're claiming basically that science is mathematics. Now, how do you defend that? Mathematically, how do you defend that? That's an indefensible claim.
Well, it seems to hold. I really like what you're kind of laying out here.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to have Dr. Peter Redpath with us.
Have you been married and have since divorced? Do you think your marital status prevents you from coming to church? Most Catholics and non-Catholics unfortunately have a lot of misconceptions about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. Pope Francis has recently encouraged all people with questions about marriage to make an appointment and talk with their parish priest. As Catholic priests, we look forward to the opportunity to help you on your journey through life. Please make an appointment to speak with the priest today. We are and will always be here for you.
Catholic Radio, changing hearts and minds.
I started listening to the Catholic Radio a few months ago. I guess I'm a little hypocritical right now because I'm not Catholic, and it just makes my day go by so much faster. I love the spiritual family that you have. I just think it's so awesome.
You can help keep Catholic Radio Indy on the air by making a donation at CatholicRadioIndy.org.
And for audience, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to our conversation here in the Catholic Cave with Dr. Peter Redpath of the Adler Aquinas Institute, Holy Apostles College and Seminary, author of many books and articles. Now, let me see if I can advance this just a little bit, Dr. Redpath, in that we've talked about what some of the underlying causes. You've talked about a very important feature of what the problem is. Tell us a little bit about, when it comes to Catholics, say, higher education, what are some of the results of things have gone awry or worse? What are some of the results? What is Catholic education, higher education? What's the outcome as a result of these this complete disconnect from philosophy?
Okay, the best reference I can make to that is C.S. Lewis's book on the Abolition of Man, Chapter 1, Men Without Chests. To the extent that you don't have a proper understanding of human nature and how education is related to developing habits of the human soul, if you don't understand what the human soul is, and that the soul is what is chiefly being educated, that education is chiefly a psychological activity, you lose an understanding of what is engaged in acts of leadership. Because you're not focusing attention on developing habits of intellectual and moral virtue. You don't develop what Lewis calls men with chests. At the beginning of the development of the church did not have an adequate understanding of the nature of the human soul. It considered the human soul to be a principle separate from the body. And this is a tradition that was established through the influence of St. Augustine. It wasn't until the 13th century with St. Thomas Aquinas that the teaching about the human soul, as well as the teaching about creation, started to become formalized in the church's self-understanding, where the human being, the soul became this principle of life, growth, and development of an animal body. According to St. Thomas and according to Lewis, a soul disconnected from a human body is not a human soul. And trying to educate people as if you were educating a spirit that does not animate and vivify a body disconnects human education from sense reality. What's happened in modernity is the only discipline that stays in connection with sense reality and tries to understand its operations is mathematical physics. All other disciplines have no understanding of how to get their principles from sense observation.
It seems like it's almost an epistemological problem too, right? Because if all of our I think maybe part of the crisis of modernity, or at least the situation we find ourselves in now, is that we tend to put all of our confidence and trust in the mathematically empirical sciences, and then when it comes to say. Judgments that are, say, more a priori around values, meaning, purposes. Well, those are kind of a judgment by a human being, and therefore seen as less reliable and therefore we discount or remove them. This is where technology, that technocratic impulse, seems to be very much displacing our self understanding of. Yeah. What really gives life meaning?
Or at the very least, you know, these other subjects, they start to try to adopt the method and methodology of mathematical science. So you wind up with economics and psychology trying to be more and more scientific, i.e. trying to bring, you know, some sort of mathematical certainty into disciplines where that's not really, you know, what the ideal ought to be.
Oh, yeah. I mean, read much of modern economics now. Requires sophisticated math to use it.
Mathematical technology is replacing classical virtue.
Yeah, you mentioned, I'm glad you brought that up again, Dr. Redpath. You mentioned both the moral and intellectual virtues. What are you getting at? What does that mean?
Well, these are psychological qualities that enable us to make right judgments, huh? About the natures of things, to be able to first of all recognize the natures of things, what things are. The mathematical physics has been claiming for several centuries that it has the only method to understand the natures of things, but simultaneously it denies that things have natures.
Right, because it's simply because we can manipulate it. Or I think I've heard you say, Dr. Redpath, we torture these materials until they reveal their secrets.
What happened was, see, for the ancient Greeks, for Aristotle chiefly, a form is a principle of organization that exists within a multitude and is able to generate from that multitude parts of a whole. If you don't have an intrinsic principle of organization that is able to harmonize a multitude into parts of a whole to generate a single act, if you don't have a multitude cooperating to generate one action, you don't have parts of a whole. The whole of science studies part-whole relationships. Right? And the chief activity of induction, right, that Francis Bacon criticized people for not understanding. I'm referring to Bacon and that notion that modern science tortures natures. Bacon said that logicians cannot understand the nature of induction. They assume that they know the nature of something, right? They don't understand the nature of anything because according to Bacon you have to torture the nature hides, it won't tell you what it is. So unless you take technologies to bombard physical things to cause them to react, you can't understand their hidden principles. But that's totally false. Bacon recognized that logicians cannot tell you what induction is, but logicians are the chief people within education who tell you what induction is. They claim that it's this principle of generalization that's made from initial sense observation, going from the particular to the universal. That's not what it is. Induction is a psychological habit, or just a naturally acquired ability, with which a person is born, by means of which an individual can observe a multitude and tell you what kind of an organization it is. Human beings, when we study things as wholes, as organizational wholes, as St. Thomas says. The office of the wise man is to order things, to understand the organization with which we are dealing, and to be able to go from a generic understanding of the organization to be able to identify the specific principles that are causing it to behave in the way that it behaves. That's the nature of science. The nature of science is to be able to study an organizational whole, which has its intrinsic principles, its intrinsic causes, for generating this or that qualitatively different kind of action, and to understand how this is occurring. That's a habit of the soul. Science exists in the human soul.
Right.
This also sounds like a great prelude to something else we wanted to talk about, which is your Aquinas, if I get the name right, Aquinas Leadership Institute, right? Isn't this sort of the backdrop to that initiative?
Yes, it is. You know, because we destroyed the principles of leadership within Western culture by eliminating the human soul.
Well, now wait a minute. You're gonna have to back up your claim, because I was at Barnes & Noble, which I consider kind of like going behind enemy lines often when I walk in there. And there's plenty of quote-unquote leadership books on the shelves. So what do you mean we've destroyed leadership in the West?
The classical virtues, the cardinal moral virtues of temperance and courage and justice and prudence,
aren't those optional when it comes to, I mean, look at our last election.
They depend upon a classical psychology.
Oh, you keep going back to that.
Yeah, they're essentially connected to the human soul as having different divisions within the human soul. You get rid of the classical understanding of the human psychology of human beings as a rational animal. You've destroyed ethics. You can't teach it. And a moral culture is the foundation for the generation. Moral psychology generates the philosophical psychology or scientific psychology that is necessary to form scientific leaders.
Is this what you brought up in your article, Men Without Chess, or is there something else you're pointing to?
Yeah. The fact that we've taken the human soul out of the human body, we can't explain how human reason can regulate and control human behavior.
Well, why would we want to control our behavior? There, I'm being a smart act there. Because notice that I think in our current setting, right, one of the major projects is. Do not constrain me, right? You should accept whatever behavior I choose to. Isn't this the bathroom issue at heart?
Well, see, that's the principle of an anarchist.
And I would argue that you were more on target, Tim, when you brought up all of those leadership books at Barnes & Noble, that rather than moral psychology and leadership in the classical sense, we've replaced that with some sort of science of management. And
in order to have science, even in the modern sense, you have to have teamwork. To have teamwork, you have to have people who have habits that enable them to cooperate. So as to harmonize their operations and achieve the satisfaction of a common activity. You have to have a single act that unifies the relationships that enable science, art and science to be born. Only a moral culture that enables people to behave justly toward one another creates the kind of psychology that enables art and science to develop. A person can be the most talented singer or dancer, a painter from the standpoint of natural ability, but that person cannot become an artist or a scientist with respect to those kinds of abilities unless that person can stay off drugs, not become addicted to alcohol, not become reckless. So the birth of an artistic and scientific culture presupposes a moral culture. The moral culture presupposes that we understand the principles of moral leadership. The moral virtues and the intellectual virtues are psychological excellences. Human science is a psychological excellence not everybody has the psychological disposition to be able to become an artist or scientist. This requires, first of all, that you have natural ability and some acquired ability, talent, and that you have to be able to exercise that talent in such a way that enables you to get along with other people, so that you don't surround yourself with enemies who aren't going to enable you to exist, to exercise your art and science.
Yeah, and we don't have to go too far back in history, I think, to see a time where education was geared towards the cultivating of these psychological excellences. You know, it used to be people would talk about people being Yale men or Harvard men, and people were identified by their character with where their pedagogy came from. And we've really lost that. I mean, you can't tell the difference between which academy people went based on their character anymore. You can kind of read about these things in books from, you know, kind of the turn of the 20th century, that people were identified by their pedagogy of where they came from.
Yeah, now Lewis understood this very well. On the basis of this scientific reductionism, the whole of true science to mathematical physics, philosophy was reduced to a systematic logic, to a kind of syllogistic logic, which had no contact with sense reality, and it became a kind of body of knowledge which consisted of this systematic logic. Now, Lewis says, look, in the third hour of embargment, a syllogism is not going to do you any good.
Right.
The person who's going to be able to withstand that, the people who are going to be able to stand that are men with chests. People who have been psychologically trained to control their emotions. Human reason is not simply an abstract kind of logical principle. Human reason is a command and control principle of animal life. Human beings are animals. This is true even of physical scientists.
Sometimes especially true of physical scientists.
Right. Hey, Dr. Redpath, before I forget, let me ask you to share. You've got this Aquinas Leadership Institute conference coming up in New York this summer. Would you be able to, how would we learn more about that? And when is it?
It's in the middle of July. I think it's July 16th to the 19th at Immaculate Conception Seminary in Huntington, Long Island. And if they go to my the Aquinas School of Leadership website, there's information about it there.
Fantastic.
And the topic for it this year is Aquinas, Augustine, and the Apologetics of the New Reformations.
Well, that sounds fantastic. I think our producer, Kent Blanford, wants to go with me now. He loves to study about the Reformations.
One of the things is that, for the most part, I'm convinced that there's little understanding both of philosophy and of the teachings of St. Thomas within contemporary Catholic colleges and universities, even among people who are supposed to be the most celebrated of people in understanding Aquinas. They missed first principles that he used. You have to understand in order to be able to understand precisely what he's saying. Now, the people who are really excited about Aquinas today tend to be non-Catholics. They tend to be evangelical Christians, secularists of one form or another, Jewish intellectuals. The church since Vatican II has been going through this hate Aquinas period, which it periodically does, and so it's seeking a kind of personalistic philosophy that can replace Aquinas and unify the different church interests, activities, the new evangelization, And the problem with that is St. Thomas is the personalistic philosophical principle they're looking for.
Right. Yeah. I mean, John Paul II kind of laid that out in Fides et Ratio, that, you know, you can look for something like personalism, but it's got
to
be
doing
found.
They're turning to a German idealism.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. If you,
which I often catch Mark doing, by the way, Dr. Redpath.
No, actually, I think that's a.
That's a false accusation.
I think that's an important distinction, that when you look towards things like phenomenology and German idealism, you have to reference them back to St. Thomas Aquinas. You have to reference them back to that psychology. And I think if you do that, you can stay on relatively safe ground. Right, Dr. Redpath?
Well, I don't know. It's pretty dangerous.
Right. Yeah, that's right, Dr. Redpath. That's right, Mark. We're going to gang up on you. Well, that's fantastic. Yeah. I think some of your – and Dr. Redpath, tell us about some of your recent books, because I know this is of great concern of yours and academic interest. So you're not only organized conferences domestically and internationally, but you've also devoted a lot of time and effort into getting these really important thoughts down on paper. So what have you published recently, and what can we look forward to?
Well, I've got that two-volume set of in metaphysics, the not-so-elementary Christian metaphysics.
By the way, folks, he means that when he says not so elementary. It's right. Wonderful, but it is waist deep, I'll put it that way. It's not a tiptoe through the tulips.
No.
Incredibly valuable, though. Incredibly valuable.
And it's, in fact, Father Shaw.
Love Father Shaw. He's fantastic.
Descartes, when he was trying to get approval for his teaching, sent it to the faculty, and the dean of the University of Paris. I would never think of doing that today.
They'd probably start.
I sent my stuff to Father Shaw.
Oh, okay, yeah. Boy, yeah. He's up there too, age-wise too. I mean, but he is as. But I think he's
dynamo.
Even. Oh yeah, I think he's producing more now that he's retired than ever before.
Yeah, and so he's been encouraging me with respect to. These works. The second volume, the first volume is chiefly related to reuniting philosophy and science and wisdom. It's remarkable to me that anybody would think that you possibly could possess science and simultaneously divorce science from wisdom.
Right. I mean, that's a recipe for disaster right there.
I mean, how could you possibly... How could you possibly be mentally stable?
And
do that. And how could you? The fact that you would do that indicates a lack of understanding of the connection of human reason with sense reality.
Right, and also there's a reality of human nature that we are directed. We are directed by purposes, and to deny that and say, well, I'm just aimlessly pursuing science, that even in itself makes no sense. I mean, science itself has to be directed towards some purpose.
Yeah, and the second volume I called An Introduction to Ragamuffin Thomism.
I love that title.
Because I think that a chief cause for the difficulty that we have in contemporary Catholic education is the poorly understood Thomism that principles that St. Thomas actually used that were proposed after Leo XIII's Aeterni Patris, huh? In trying to rediscover St. Thomas, we have not properly understood the chief principles that he was using to develop his tremendous organizational genius. I've been fascinated by Aquinas' organizational genius and how he was able to organize his works the way he did. And how it is that when people study St. Thomas, very often, even if they don't understand him perfectly, they become masterful organizers. Ralph McInerney is a good example of this. Etienne Gilson is Gilson was the author of something like close to 1,000 different pieces of work, huh? 172 books, monographs, for example. That's absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, how could anybody do this? Kind of, you know.
And that's not the only thing he was doing.
No.
You know? Yeah. That just kind of came along with all the other projects he was up to.
Right.
Yeah, but the reason that St. Thomas was an organizational genius was because he conceived of a substance, huh, of really existing things as organizational wholes. and he considered philosophy chiefly, science chiefly, to be a habit of the soul, that generically, had as its subject, some kind of operational organization. And different sciences have different organizations, that they're interested in understanding in relationship to the parts and the wholes that cause them to act the way they do. Without a chief aim, an end that exists within a multitude, you can't have a real organization. Real organizations don't exist. And this is the problem of modern thought. It denies the reality of real organizations. It gets rid of the intrinsic principle of unity that causes organization. What the ancient Greeks, Aristotle in particular, calls a nature or a form. Once you get rid of that intrinsic principle and you replace it by external laws, that are not part of the intrinsic constitution of the thing, that's like taking a contemporary business organization and maintaining that the principles of the organization don't exist within it, but they exist within external constraints, behavioral restraints placed by governmental agencies on what you're doing. Now, anybody that's in business would understand that's ridiculous. That's absurd. Huh?
Right.
That the organization, in and through the talents of the people that are able to harmonize according to a chief principle, which is the end.
Right, right.
We're all aiming and have the ability to generate, like putting out this fire or building this house or that house. Without real aims, without their real ends, there are no real wholes. There are no real parts. There are no real organizations. And if that's the case, there's no real science.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I feel like we're just scratching the surface, but we're also out of time. So thank you so much, Dr. Peter Redpath. Hey, I want to mention to everyone that, because I'm going to go, so if you want to meet me in person and Dr. Redpath, learn more about what we've been talking about in terms of Catholic education, but especially around leadership, make sure that you check out the information at the Adler Aquinas Institute. And I'm going to be at and joining Dr. Redpath and many, many other great Catholic scholars, other people who are interested in this topic, at the 4th Annual Aquinas Leadership International World Congress. And this is going to be Thursday, July 13th through Sunday, July 16th. We're going to be at the Immaculate Conception Seminary. That is on Long Island. So I can't wait to see you there. We might even try to broadcast from there.
Huntington, Long Island, and I'm going to be in Chicago on May the 6th at St. John Chrysostom Episcopal Church doing a eulogy for Max Wiseman, who was the co-founder with Mortimer J. Adler of the Center for the Study of the Great Ideas, at 3 p.m. For anybody who might be in the Chicago area. Max was a man with a chest.
God rest his soul. That was such that is a watershed project that they engaged in, I would say. So thank you again, Dr. Redpath, for all you do. We look forward to speaking to you again real soon here in the Catholic Cave.
Thank you much, Robert. Have a good day.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of the Catholic Cave. If you have a question or comment regarding this program, please address an email to Kent, K-E-N-T, at catholicradioindy.org or call 317-870-8400. Replays of this program are available on podcast at catholicradioindy.org. Just click on the programming tab, then go to podcasts of local programs.